Welcome to From Today. In this podcast series, we aim to bring Erich Fromm's humanism and social psychology to life for the present. How can Fromm's thinking help us to face the social challenges of our time? In the podcast, we talk to Fromm experts and other people of interest who explain and expand on Fromm's perspective and apply it to our time in the 21st century. In this episode, Thomas Kuhn and I, Jonathan Keir, talk to Susan Neiman, who is a German-American philosopher with a theoretical focus on the philosophy of enlightenment. For example, the works of Immanuel Kant, as well as moral philosophy and political philosophy more generally. As director of the Einstein Forum in Potsdam, Susan confirmed her allegiance to the left liberal Jewish intellectual tradition with the best-selling 2023 book, Left Is Not Woke. Through her engagement with the humanist values of the Enlightenment and her exploration of the concrete efforts of theoretical reflections on political practice, we see a kinship between her thinking and that of Erich Fromm. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Jonathan.
Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Glad to be here.
As promised, this won't be an exam on your knowledge of Erich Fromm. Fromm is a benign figure hovering in the background of this conversation. So we'll get to him in due course indirectly. But I see a copy, a German copy of your book, Left Is Not Woke, sitting in front of me, in front of Thomas. You've probably answered this question 100 times, but I'm going to ask it for the 101st time. If left is not woke, what is it?
I'm glad that you asked that question, because usually the questions come the other way around. People want me to define woke, when actually the book was an attempt to define what left means today. We can talk later, if you like, about the impossibility of defining woke. But let's start with the left, because I think people have become incredibly confused about whether the term left even makes sense today. And that is partly has to do with the woke movement. As we know, the terms left and right came from the seating arrangements of the 1789 Paris Parliament. And it may seem a little bit strange to still be defining our political allegiances according to what was just a contingent fact. If they'd sat on the other side, we'd be doing it the other way around. But I do think that there are some coherent ideas and traditions running from the Enlightenment up to today that do define what left is. Or, let me put this more carefully, what left should be. I'm not a historian, I'm a philosopher. I know that the left has often failed to live up to its own ideals. We can discuss that if you like. But first of all, I think there are three ideas that are common to liberals and leftists. Okay? The first is that we're universalists, okay? We don't believe, as tribalists do, that you can only genuinely connect with people from your own tribe and therefore don't have any either serious connections or serious obligations towards anyone else. That is a reactionary view that goes back. We can, you know, think about who it goes back to. It has a very long tradition. You see that in the French Counter-Enlightenment. You see that in Carl Schmitt. whereas for the left and for liberals, the idea was, in addition to all of the cultural differences that we have, there is a human dignity in every single person that we ought to respect. That doesn't mean, of course, that everybody's the same. And I enjoy cultural differences as much as anybody does. But I also know that I, like millions of other people on the left for centuries, that it's possible to recognize and enjoy the humanity in every single human being. So that's the first principle, common both to leftists and liberals. The second principle is the idea that in principle it's possible to separate power from justice and to work towards universal justice. Now, obviously, it's proven very hard to do that in practice. You have people like, let's just take, I think, a non-controversial example at this point, George W. Bush's claim to bring democracy to the Middle East via attacks on Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, left-wing Americans didn't believe this for a second, or very few did. It was interesting to see how many Europeans said, "Well, it was a nice ideal, but unfortunately, Americans are too naive to carry it out." That's ridiculous. He was never interested in bringing democracy to the Middle East, nor were most of his staff. It was about oil, hegemony, and geopolitics. Okay, so you have a situation which somebody's making a claim about an idea of justice when really they're only reaching for power and they're covering it up with something that they think will convince other people. That happens all the time. But it doesn't mean that it's impossible to separate claims of justice and claims of power, okay? Simple example. In pre-Enlightenment days, if the peasant stole a deer from the lord to feed his family, he could be hanged. There are all of these ballads about people being hanged for stealing a deer, and that was just the law. If, on the other hand, the lord wanted to take the peasant's daughter for a night, that was also perfectly permissible. That is, there wasn't a sense of justice that applied both to the peasant and to the lord of the manor. Okay, and basically, Enlightenment claims for human rights are always based on the idea that it's possible to separate power and justice. Okay, liberal and leftist idea. Third liberal and leftist idea is the idea that it's possible to work towards progress. And here, progress is very definitely moral progress. Technological progress is useful if it contributes to freedom and justice for the greatest number of people. Again, we've grown quite concerned, if not absolutely skeptical, about progress, but think about what was being asserted here. It's not that human beings are condemned to original sin. It's not that there was some golden age that we inevitably decayed from. Okay, it's that it's possible people work together, that they can create a better world for themselves and for others, okay? So those are three principles that are common to liberals and leftists. There's a fourth principle that distinguishes left from liberal, namely, if you're on the left, you believe that social rights to fair labor practices, housing, education, healthcare, access to culture are genuine rights that are as important as political rights. They're not benefits, they're not privileges, they're not things that it would be nice to have, they're genuine rights. So that's the difference between left and liberal philosophically. At this point, where we see proto-fascism growing on every continent, and I wrote the book out of deep concern about that, I'm happy to build alliances with liberals, and I think we all should be. Let's see us being in a moment that's comparable to where Germany was somewhere in mid-1932, where social democrats and communists could not form a coalition together which allowed the Nazis to take power. Okay, so I'm very much in favor of the left not condemning liberals out of the court, but to forming alliances with them. But I've always stood on the left.
Thank you very much for this really great explanation, and also for the book you wrote. So, as Jonathan said, it's not about asking questions only about Eric Fromm, but we're here at the Eric Fromm Study Center, and I'm co-director of the Eric Fromm Study Center, and very happy to discuss with you about certain similarities I see with the work of Eric Fromm. And I think Eric Fromm considered himself to be a radicalist humanist, and one of the key questions for him is to discuss what is it that constitutes human beings and what makes us human. And I think especially in the time we live now, also with artificial intelligence, the question is as relevant as never before. And he also considered himself a humanist socialist, so questions of social justice were very central in his books. So I think there's a lot of overlap also in the question, which I found really interesting when you talk about progress, because I think especially when we see the left in the moment, there's a lot of discussion and we face a lot of challenges. We face climate crisis, for example, we face polarization, the race of nationalism, but to think about how progress is possible. And I think discussing growth for Eric Fromm also was a very important question, because I think he has this differentiation between biophilia and necrophilia, for example, and biophilia is strongly linked to growth. So having the similarities, how come that we have such a crisis about the left? Why this question you raise, what is the left, is so relevant in the moment, and why it's so complicated to find a common understanding?
So let me say that when Jonathan invited me, I immediately told him I read some Fromm decades ago. If I have time, I'd like to look at him again, because you're not the only people. I've heard from someone else recently that my work has things in common with Eric Fromm's. It's been an extremely busy time, and I have not reread him. So I can't, I really can't, I try only to speak about things that I know something about.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I can't talk about Eric Fromm, though he's now on my list to read some more.
Great.
Look, I mean, there are lots of reasons why the left is in crisis, but the one that I have focused on is that left is being confused with woke. And the simplest way to explain it is that, so I talked about ideas in trying to set out some basic principles of the left. Of course, you're also concerned with emotions, and we all are. And I think the woke are driven by traditional left-wing emotions. That is, when in doubt, I want to be on the side of the underdog. I want to be on the side of the people who are oppressed. I want to repair historical crimes, and where they can't be repaired, they should at least be commemorated. So all of those are traditional left emotions, and I share them. The problem is that I think so much of the left today is undermined by a host of reactionary ideas that they're not even entirely aware of. And they're exactly the opposite of the three first principles that I named. That is, I think the woke are extremely tribal. I think discussions of things like cultural appropriation, just simply show a tribalist bent, that people's cultures are irrevocably divided. And moreover, I don't use the word identity politics because I think it begs the question that it assumes. All of us have lots of identities. Our identities are composed of lots of features of ourselves. But the woke tend to reduce our identities to two factors. One is our ethnic background, and the other is our sex, not gender, sex. And those are both things that we don't choose. So we're actually being reduced to features of our lives that we don't choose, can't do anything about, and identified fundamentally as members of a group rather than individuals, which, you know, again, nobody actually does in practice. That's what's so funny. I start this example because one hears that so many of the world, people in the world searching for partners, find them on partner, what are they called? Websites. Yeah? Okay. If you were filling out a form in search of a new partner, would you think it would be enough to say white man? I mean, clearly not, okay? That might come up in somebody's self-description, but no one in the world would think that, you know, that was enough to say about your identity, or your qualification for a job, or anything else that was actually important to your life. Those are not the identities that we use in a serious way. But they are the identities that are most important to the woke, and the world gets simply divided in those ways. And it's both humanly reductive and politically enormously divisive. Okay. The second thing is, while you do hear people on the woke left talking about justice, as a matter of fact, they very often speak as if justice is impossible and therefore we're only out for power for our group, okay? And again, I hold Michel Foucault responsible for a whole trend that's actually extremely reactionary, but somehow manages to count as left. I realize Foucault died in the early 80s, and I've often been criticized, why don't I talk about who reads Foucault now? The answer is everybody. He is the most cited author in both the social sciences and the humanities, at least as of 2020. And as of 2022, in particular, the most cited author anywhere in post-colonial studies, right? So even if people are focusing on his acolytes and people who were influenced by him, he was the theorist that everybody of a certain generation read in college, and there were certain basic sort of general philosophical ideas that were passed on from him. And one is, there is no distinction between justice and power. It's all just power. And the third is, there's no real progress. Every time you take a step forward, you're unwittingly taking two steps back. And his brilliant takedown of that was in his most read book, Discipline and Punish, in which begins with this horrifying description of someone who tried to assassinate King Louis XV being drawn and quartered and pulled apart by four horses or six horses to a cheering, watching crowd in Paris in the 1750s. And it was brilliant of Foucault to take this as an example for attacking the Enlightenment, because one of the things that the Enlightenment's first triumphs was to get rid of using torture as a judicial measure, that is, to force people to confess. And that was just absolutely standard through the early 18th century. But he then goes on to talk about the penal system. Now, he never actually says, bring back drawing and quartering. But you cannot read that book without coming away with the conclusion, you know, the present penal system is worse than drawing and quartering. So that's a trope. You see that in every newspaper. And you don't even have to have read Foucault. What does a news journalist get rewarded for writing about. It's not ever, you know, the council brought in this new policy and it's actually changed the lives of people for the better. The journalist gets a raise or a promotion or a prize for saying the council passed this motion, which was supposed to make the lives of people better, but look, it's made it worse in all these ways. Okay, that's the kind of trope that gets rewarded in journalism, in the culture in general, and it's a very woke trope. Okay, so I understand many people who have said, I guess I'm not left anymore. That was actually the impetus for writing this book, or friends saying, I don't know what's happening to the left, but I guess I don't belong to the left anymore. And then thinking about why there was this confusion, because the people I was discussing with were all, you know, spent their lives on the left, some more with practice, some more with theory, but social justice fighters from the beginning, feeling deeply alienated from what is now called the left or the far left or the hard left or the radical left, feeling, no, actually, I thought I was the radical left, but this, you know, attack on cultural appropriation or only people from a certain tribe have the right to speak about a subject, this is not based on ideas that I can believe in, and I just wanted to untangle the ideas in the hope that that would strengthen the left and perhaps convince some of the woke to rethink the assumptions that they often don't even know that they hold. Question of to what extent writers can actually make changes in the world, and I think we can, and I think we do, and I think we have. That is the whole point of the Enlightenment. The question is whether we can make them quickly enough to stop a total disaster, and I don't know about that.
You are busy organizing a festival coming up this summer in Berlin, Potsdam, dedicated to the legacy of the Enlightenment, critical reflection around the Enlightenment. What does the Enlightenment mean today? How does the Enlightenment play out in other parts of the world that have perhaps been colonized by Western powers? How is it playing out within Western societies? I guess the follow-up question to what you've just been saying would run something like this. When you set yourself up as a Western defender of the Enlightenment, armies of woke critics are there to tell you that this is just the latest iteration of Western intellectuals masquerading as if they're bringing democracy to the Middle East or Enlightenment values to the rest of the world, but actually trying to bring some version of Western power. The question I have would be, and hopefully this summer we're going to be talking about this, you're going to be talking about this a lot more, and you're inviting some very interesting people from all over the world to get to the bottom of some of these issues. There's obviously a constructive tone to find in international relations where one can recognize that the Enlightenment was produced in the West, but one can also recognize that the universalist impulses of the Enlightenment are not unique to the West, and that although the Enlightenment took root in a specific Western context at a specific time, 17th, 18th century, you can see examples, whether it's in early Islamic culture or in Tang Dynasty China or in other cultural contexts, where the anti-tribalism you describe, where the humanism, the idea of the dignity of the individual human being is nevertheless celebrated. And I wonder how you'd react to the obvious criticism of insisting on the Western Enlightenment in such a way that people might assume that what you're saying is that only the West could have, and of course only the West did produce the Enlightenment at the time that it did, but you have seeds of humanism in other cultures, and that it would be wrong to marginalize them, especially as a post-colonial Western academic that you have a kind of responsibility, an extra responsibility, not to defend the Western versions of these universalist principles, but to go out and celebrate some of the other ones. I think of an author like Pankaj Mishra, for example, who's been very critical of Western intellectuals attempting to hide behind the Enlightenment. And obviously some of your critics have accused you of doing the same thing. I think not successfully, but the accusations have certainly come in. How do you respond to those kinds of accusations?
Well, first of all, it's not the Western Enlightenment that I'm defending, although to quote the extremely, really important Ghanaian philosopher Ato Sekiotu, whom I quote in my book, I tried so hard to get him to come to one of these conferences. He's old and ailing. We have a very nice correspondence going on, but he really feels he can't travel anymore, even though I offered him every possible inducement. He says, look, the West formalized and worked out certain principles that I recognize in my native Akan, okay? It's not a Western Enlightenment, it's a universal Enlightenment. He's the author of a book called Left Universalism, an Afrocentric Perspective. Another place to begin to address the post-colonialists. And let's begin by making a distinction between anti-colonialism and post-colonial theory, okay? Those are two very different things. And post-colonial theorists often slide between the two and suggest that anybody who questions post-colonial theory is somehow an imperialist. They've also misappropriated some of their own heroes. I just read a long piece for the New York Review on Frantz Fanon, because while I was working on this book, I reread some Fanon, and I was very surprised to find him, he's an existentialist universalist, fundamentally. He is not a post-colonial theorist. And so I wanted to do some more work on him, and I wrote a long essay on that. But what the post-colonial theorists forget, and I rather think few of them have actually read an Enlightenment text, even something as simple as Voltaire's Candide, the complaints that they're making, that one shouldn't be Eurocentric and one should take lessons from the rest of the world, also to criticize Europe, that's an Enlightenment claim. Nobody came up with that before the Enlightenment, okay? And they wrote their criticisms of European policies and conceptions of private property and sexual mores and all of that. They wrote their criticisms in the voices of Persians and Tahitians and Native Americans, and oh my gosh, how they used the Chinese to attack European assumptions. And they were all very clear about that. So, you know, the post-colonialists are almost undermining themselves, but they're certainly showing their ignorance when they suggest that the Enlightenment was a white Eurocentric patriarchal movement, when it was the Enlightenment that first said, hey guys, there's a whole globe, and we need to stop judging the world in terms of our rather narrow perspective on things. So that's the first thing to say. You're about to ask something.
No, I was just thinking, I mean, I'm thinking, and as you're talking, we've been talking about identity, I'm rereading Amin Maalouf at the moment with his Identité Meurtrière, which seems a very important thing to be reading this year again. It's 25 years old now, but he absolutely concedes that the Western Enlightenment was an unprecedented event in human history, and it would be crazy for anybody to question that. However, if you're not from that culture, then there's a question, you've got an identity dilemma about how you're going to accept the universalism of this foreign culture. And part of the way you'll do it is to it's better if you can find roots of it within your own culture. And so you have a difficult dilemma, because there are elements of Enlightenment culture, seedlings or sprouts of it or different versions of it in African communities, in, let's say, Islamic tradition, in Chinese Confucianism, anywhere, pick your civilization, wherever you want to go.
Indian.
Exactly, wherever you want to go. But that it's precisely out of the dialogue or the difficult questioning that particularly people who are born outside of the West have to do, because they're confronted with this thing which has been so overwhelmingly powerful in its moral aspect, parallel to its technological aspect, and maybe we can disentangle those two things. But obviously the Enlightenment brings with it not only new moral and political ideas, but accompanied by such overwhelming technological progress that the peoples of the earth Japan is obviously the example that Maluf picks out. They were the first country to really grasp the fact we have to compete with the West militarily, taking a very Foucauldian approach, I suppose, that the world is nothing but power. We need power, we need to militarize, we need to industrialize along Western lines. So you have parallel to this incredible economic transformation, a transformation in language around values, human rights, the French Revolution, and universalist principles. But in order to adopt those principles as one's own, at the same time as your country is being colonized by Western powers, is maybe a bit too much to ask. And so there's a sense in which it might be better for a universalist to talk about the Western Enlightenment, the aspects of the Western Enlightenment as having been important, but to emphasize as much as they possibly can the same or that those universalist sprouts in other cultures, and that over insisting on the uniqueness of the Western Enlightenment, even though it's obviously...
Yeah, but I don't do this.
No.
I mean, other people might, but I absolutely don't do this. And one of the conferences that we're doing, Enlightenment in the World, also partly supported by the Schlecht Stiftung, is precisely to take thinkers from formerly colonized countries. I don't like the expression post-colonial because it's just been warped in certain ways, who work on Enlightenment values in their own traditions. We have a Muslim professor of literature from Senegal who's been working for years on the African Enlightenment in Muslim countries in Africa. And we have a number of, I know you're going to speak about China, not my specialties, but honestly, certainly if you look at Al-Andalus on the Iberian Peninsula, it was far ahead of, in terms of basic ideas of the Enlightenment, than were Northern European countries at the time. So I'm really an Enlightenment universalist. That is, I don't think these ideas are unique to the West at all. I mean, I'll look at the book that you're talking about again, but I don't find it fundamentally problematic. But I will say there is something I do find problematic. You see it most clearly in the practice of Narendra Modi in this day and age, who every time he is accused of human rights violations by supporting pogroms against Muslim Indians, he says, human rights is a Western concept, okay? It's not part of our tradition, and of course it is part of many Indian traditions, not Hindutva. It's not part of our tradition in any way. You colonized us, so we're not listening to you anymore. And you saw this with Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, and you see it in many, many places, including some of the post-colonial theorists. So I get worried when I see the possibility for real abuse in the names of, we were colonized, so we're not going to listen to you. Interestingly enough, philosopher who is coming, a Nigerian philosopher named Olofemi Taiwo, has written a book called Against Decolonization, in which he points out this fascinatingly simple fact. The Iberian Peninsula was colonized by Moors for... Moor is still in English an okay expression. I realize the Germans get upset about it, but it isn't considered discriminatory in English when we're speaking English. The Iberian Peninsula was colonized for 700 years, whereas the African continent was colonized for about 100. And you don't see the Spanish and Portuguese telling the history of their country as if all that ever happened was the colonization. So, I mean, he's arguing against the idea of seeing the entire narrative of post-colonial history in terms of the colonial period. And I know an Indian historian who will also be there. And so, you know, there are other voices right now in the so-called global South. They're not the ones whose voices are being amplified at the moment in the West. And I'm not sure what that's about. I don't know whether, I mean, I think there's a combination of circumstances. I think there's a sense of guilt among many Europeans and North Americans. And yes, there are things that we ought to feel guilty for. I think we did not pay enough attention to the process of decolonialization and the anti-colonial history. I think it all came, it all really came very quickly. If you go, they may have changed it since I was there last, but the Dutch Museum for National History began with, I don't know, maps and nice pictures of burghers and the Dutch Golden Age and all of that. And it ended, interestingly enough, with the Nazi occupation of Holland. And I was shocked because, of course, there was no word about Indonesia. There was no word about the quite brutal anti-colonial struggle in Indonesia. And there are two ways to explain it. One is it just happened really fast, okay? The decolonial period, the anti-colonial wars, followed very closely and not accidentally on the heels of World War II. And people were coping with lots of different things. But the other, and I suspect psychologically more plausible and problematic reason for the way this Dutch museum, and I suggest lots of other places, that's just an example of a place where it screamed out at me. People would rather think about their own victimization than the ways in which they victimized other people. So that was the focal point, I think, for many decades in the global north. But it's an attitude. I mean, guilt is a problematic emotion that often hinders people from doing the right thing. And simply listening to the post-colonial voices who shout the loudest, everything you did was rotten to the core, and we don't want to hear any more about it. Listening to those people at the expense of the others who are less famous and sell fewer books and perhaps have, you know, less good university positions or journalistic positions or whatever, that's a mistake. We need to listen to a plurality of voices. And frankly, I think it's racist to assume that the voices who... whose center the fact of colonial oppression as the most important fact of their existence are are the only genuinely authentic voices. I think we need to listen to all kinds of voices. And you see something similar going on in the U.S., where African-Americans who don't want the fact of discrimination to be their focal point are considered conservative black voices, even if they're not. There was a terrific movie that came out around Christmas called American Fiction. Either of you see it? It's brilliant. I highly recommend it. It's about a very educated black author who, you know, knows several languages, and he's writing fairly complicated novels with allusions to Greek tragedy and stuff like that, and they're not selling. And his agent is on his back about, come on, you write something that sells. Write something about the black experience. So he writes a caricature of a novel about a rather loathsome young man from the ghetto in, you know, grammatically incorrect English and all kinds of, you know, with all kinds of tropes. And he writes it as a joke, and it becomes not only a bestseller, it wins the National Book Award, and everybody is talking about how authentic it is. And it's a really good description of a certain move that many people of color are rather angry about at the moment.
Maybe I can link to something. You mentioned psychology several times now, the emotions, and as we are here at a university called International Psychoanalytic University, and I consider myself a critical social psychologist, I'm trying to find some links, what you say, what is very interesting, but from a very philosophical point of view, also to psychology and to critical psychology. And so two questions I have in this regard. I worked together a lot in the Brazilian context with Brazilian colleagues from sociology who also consider themselves left, and they have stronger than in my context the notion of class, for example. And I would wonder what you think about class, and maybe linking this also, and this could be linked to Eric Fromm also, and to psychoanalytic considerations. When we talk about class, we also talk about class consciousness, for example, and like the way people in different social contexts and different social embeddings have the possibility and the ability to develop certain feelings, certain emotions, and also some things what might be thought are considered appropriate, other things have to be left unconscious. And for example, Eric Fromm, he coined the concept of social character and says, like, when you live in certain social contexts, you have certain similar ways of feeling, but also of pressing certain kind of thoughts, for example. And also from my biographic research, I can find in different social contexts, for example, there's developed a kind of pride of arranging with circumstances, whereas others have a pride maybe of being very successful, which could be a kind of marketing character, for example, in a certain sense. So how would you relate these kind of discussions to the more abstract concept of universal enlightenment, and how do you see like the meaning of class, and especially in the international context, like having different countries, for example, different the possibility to develop a consciousness? Because one, of course, could argue that this kind of identity politics makes certain groups more visible and also empowers them to have a voice in a certain way.
You know, I'm just reading something I've written by an Indian historian, you know, about the ways in which the left often said nationalism was important in liberation struggles as a first step. And it sounded like a good argument. Lenin made it, among other people. Except we know from lots of contexts, Algerian revolution is a really good example that Fanon got stuck on, that because nationalism may seem to be the easiest common denominator, it's also a place where people stay, all right? And it's also open to all kinds of abuse. So I've become, from what I know of the history of some liberation movements, I've become quite suspicious of the idea that, well, let's appeal to nationalism while we're fighting against particularly against foreign invaders or foreign colonizers, because we'll work it all out later on. We'll form our national consciousness, and then we'll be proud and self-sufficient, and we can go on to build a more just society. You don't see it happening, actually. I mean, it's very hard for me to think of an example. In fact, you often see things going exactly the other way. Look at the state of Israel today, all right? You know, it's fallen into a reactionary, radical right nationalism that was absolutely opposed to what the founders intended. Class. Look, class is important. I mean, it would be idiotic for me to claim that it's not, just as it would be idiotic for me to claim that sex is not important, or that ethnic heritage is not important. I could talk for an hour about sexism in Germany if I wanted to, which is significantly worse and more unpleasant than it is in the United States at this point. But I don't like class reductionism any more than I like gender or race reductionism. I think, you know, trying to define us along any one axis is a problem. And, you know, think about it. Neither Marx, nor Engels, nor Lenin, nor Trotsky were in any sense working class. I mean, they didn't come from... And actually, if you look at even pre-left-wing revolutionaries, if you look at the, you know, the figures of the Enlightenment, maybe you could count Rousseau, but not really. I mean, he came from an artisan class. He did not come from a working class background. Kant actually came more from a working class background than did Rousseau. But I mean, I think the history and the biographies of all of the revolutionaries I just mentioned are enough to say, look, the people actually wrote left-wing theory and to some extent shaped left-wing practice were class traitors, if you want to use that kind of language. So yes, there's a habitus, as you know, Bourdieu taught us. There are all kinds of cultural things that make certain things easier for people and certain things harder. But it's certainly possible to work one's ways out of them. I will say, though, that the moment when I was most conscious of a class privilege in my own case was a situation in which one of my children, unfortunately, was sick for quite a while. I don't have private health insurance. I mean, I don't have money that could have been helpful. But what I did have was the confidence that, say, if the doctors did something wrong or an insurance company did something wrong, that one could contest it. And this child was, you know, in the state hospital system and hearing from people, it's pointless. Die da oben, you know, the guys up there will always do things by their rules, and there is nothing whatsoever that we can do to protest or complain or change a situation. And it was a moment when I felt, gosh, this sense of resignation and hopelessness is certainly beaten into certain people. Not even sure that working class is the right word to use, but down on the class privilege scale. And that's perhaps the most important thing that those of us who are not there or worked our ways out of it have. But again, good community organizing is about empowering people and showing them that they do have the capacity to make change in their own lives as not as easily as anybody else, but it's there. In halfway functioning democracies, let's say.
We haven't talked about economics much yet. And given that you've stated that you're committed to being a leftist, the most obvious critique is, where is the money for any kind of utopian leftist vision going to come from? In other words, what's going to, how are people going to be motivated to work hard and produce if a system is set up where there's no incentive to do that? You emphasise that you believe in the idea of economic rights, essentially, whether that takes the form of healthcare or education subsidies and other social service subsidies, but effectively it amounts to a kind of guaranteed basic income or at least guaranteed access to certain basic economic resources. Do you have a position on something like a universal basic income and whether it whether that would kill motivation or kill the economy as we know it? Do you have a 21st century post-socialist, post-capitalist model of economic integration? I'm thinking of your role as the director of the Einstein Forum. Einstein himself was famously neither a communist nor he viewed communism, Soviet communism, and Western capitalism more or less as equally nefarious modes of economic and social organization.
And so he called himself a socialist.
Yes.
Yes.
But so then I guess my question is to you, is, are you, I mean, perhaps I can ask the question this way. Would you be relatively close to Einstein? Would you consider yourself more of a social democrat than a socialist? Do you have a view on something like the German soziale Marktwirtschaft, in which we have the privilege of living? Do you have, in terms of the just the economics of a leftist vision, a 21st century vision, do you have a...
Well,
plausible.
Since I'm not an economist, I have to rely on reading other economists. And one whom I've learned from and also quote is Thomas Piketty. Thomas Piketty says that one could have gradual socialism in each country through the introduction of the degree of taxation that was common in the U.S. and in Britain and in France during the immediate post-war 30 years, which was the time of the highest rate of growth, okay? So the idea that high taxation kills growth is apparently just empirically false, okay? And it's also interesting, I was just reading an article in the New Yorker about the super wealthy and this seeming paradox that, of course, according to the theories of the super wealthy, you need economic inequality in order to motivate production. But the fact that while it used to be the case that wealthy people did not work, I mean, way up into the 19th century, it was viewed as... that's right. It was vulgar, I mean, to have to have a job. It's now the case that most super wealthy people pride themselves on working harder than anybody else and acknowledging, you know, actually for the purposes of providing comfort and pleasure for my family, I could have stopped decades ago. In some cases, they quote people as saying that. So you don't miss your 26th billion. It's part of a game that you're in if you're in that category of capitalist. So I actually don't think people only work for money, and you see that not only people with jobs like mine, or I take it both of yours. I mean, we're hopefully reasonably paid for our labors, but we also work way beyond. I mean, an hourly, if I divided my salary by an hourly wage, It would be quite ridiculous. But I work a lot because I'm privileged to love what I'm doing, okay? And I would presumably do it if I weren't being paid for it, if I were managing to live elsewhere. But you see this even in studies of people who don't have particularly creative or intellectual jobs, that people are terrified of retiring and actually don't want to retire or are stuck because simply the daily habit of getting up in the morning and feeling that your presence in the world matters, okay? You're being useful to someone as a bus driver or a baker. That's an important human feeling, to feel that we are, first of all, we're doing something that makes sense, and that is regarded as such by some group of people in the world, okay? So I think there's plenty of empirical evidence that suggests, on the one hand, even people with not terribly good jobs want to keep doing them, and secondly, the people who have billions work when compensation is no longer a factor in their working. I see it as possible. Whether it will happen is another question. As far as whether I'm a socialist or a social democrat, I'm not sure that those terms have any meaning. There was one critical review of the book in a German magazine saying, oh, she's not really a leftist, she's just a social democrat. Well, I must say, I'm not a social democrat along the lines of the current makeup of the German Social Democratic Party, but I'm not sure that many people do. I don't understand why anybody today, in a world that's on the brink of ecological crisis and is armed to the teeth, that anybody would want to argue in favor of violent revolution. I think that's ought to be off the table. But I do think, again, following Piketty, there's some other people who I've read on the subject, but he's the person I've read the most of, that it would be possible to gradually introduce a genuine social democracy which went beyond the Sozialmarktwirtschaft that we currently live under.
One thing I like as a...
Let me add one more.
Yeah,
let me
sure.
add one more point to
sure.
this. I think I put this example in the book because it's one of these fun facts, as they call them in the U.S., that blows me away every time. Let me put it the other way around. Malala, youngest Nobel Prize winner in history, figured out, after she had won her fight for women's education and gone to Oxford and done all the things that she did, she figured out with that education that you could finance 12 years worth of education for every boy and girl on the planet on the profits made by the arms industry in 8 days. 8 days. And I read this claim because I thought it was interesting that it wasn't getting a lot of play, whereas, once again, tribalism. Malala is honored and feted for nearly losing her life in the fight for girls' rights to get an education. But why are people not talking about what she finds out once she gets an education? And I happened to be, shortly after I read that, I happened to be at a meeting of a working group that I'm involved in, the economists and philosophers and business leaders. And I asked Amartya Sen, another Nobel laureate in economics, and I said, she makes this claim, can that possibly be true? And he took a piece of paper and he made some calculations and said, yeah, that's about right. Now, when you ask where we're going to get the money from, Malala Yousafzai has an idea for that. I don't live in a world, actually, at a day-to-day level, where I'm aware of just how much money is wasted, misallocated, exactly. But even just wasted. I was talking to somebody recently who was telling me, I guess I better not say which company he works for, a major auto company, how much money was lost because of a linguistic mistake. And he said, 100 billion. And I said, you do mean 100 million. He said, no, 100 billion. You know, I don't even know how to think in those terms, but they're the people who do confirm that there's just plenty of money to go around to get basic education, healthcare, housing, etc. It's there.
Already, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, having said so, I mean, what you said, I think there are plenty of things to get sad about and also to worry about. But one thing I liked in your book was when you showed how important courage is and was for all the Enlightenment main actors and the theory. And when I think of Eric Fromm, he in 1968 wrote the book Revolution of Hope. So how important hope as well is. And when you link being left to progress, is there any hope? And where do you see hope? And or in other words, if left is not woke, what we as the left protagonists somehow should do more? How can we spread hope? How can we do something to?
Well, you're putting another book on my list that I need to read and haven't. That one I never read. But look, I think the first thing you have to realize is that hope is not an emotion; it's a moral obligation, and that's a view of Kant, okay, who is not by any means the figures of the Enlightenment are often painted as, you know, optimistic fools. No, those are the people they attack. All you need to do is read Candide and see that it's, you know, optimism that's being attacked. There's a difference between optimism and hope. Optimism is a statement about the facts, and the facts are really not good. Hope is the belief in the possibility of changing the facts.
From Sess as well, yeah.
Pardon, from Sess, okay. Yeah. So maybe you got it from Kant, maybe not. I had the privilege of interviewing Noam Chomsky a couple of years ago. I just read yesterday, he's had a stroke. This is why we haven't heard from him for a while. But he was going strong at 93 when I spoke to him. And he basically made the same argument that this is, you know, that the world really will go to hell if we don't hope, and points out, of course, that there are many, many people across the world in different countries who are standing up with courage for their and other people's rights. And if they're not giving up, neither can we. And I said, yeah, you know, that's an argument of Kant's. He said, no, I didn't know that. I said, okay. But whether you take your lessons from Kant or Chomsky or Fromm, I guess, it's an obligation. That's what there is. I suppose those of us who put children into the world might feel that obligation particularly keenly. I've seen sometimes pessimism grow in people as they get older if they have no children. But I think even people who don't have children can sort of think metaphorically, do you really want all this to end with your end? Or do you think you have some obligation to give something back to the world in exchange for the gift of having lived in it? And I do think that's an obligation we all have.
You've obviously been very busy the last 12 months with Left Is Not Woke. It's been translated into, you'll tell me exactly how many languages by now?
10 so far.
Yeah, okay. Is there a follow-up project? Is there another? Is there a book project in the oven? Is there something that or one book? In my experience, always one leads naturally into the next.
Yes.
What are you secretly working on?
Well, it's not so much of a secret. I'm not working on it right now at all because, as you said, Left Is Not Woke came out of a lot of countries. It was really very interesting and exciting to go to Chile and Brazil, two places that have left-wing governments that have been, however, plagued by the phenomenon of woke there, which is almost one-to-one with a North American European discussion, but it was interesting anyway. A lot of interesting debates and discussions there. So I've been doing that, and I've also been preparing this Enlightenment Festival. But I wrote this book while I was already working on another project that I've been working on for a long time, and I thought, okay, I just have this relatively short thing to say, and I'll do it, and I'll put it aside, and then I'll go back to the other book. The book is tentatively called Heroes for an Age of Victimhood. And there are a couple of pages in the book which do touch on that problem, which is that we have moved the subject of history from being the hero to being the victim, and to try to figure out how that happened, and also to propose an alternative conceptions of heroism. Victims they're not agents, okay? And the problem with the shift to focusing the subject of history on the victim, it sounded like a great idea in the beginning, like lots of things. It used to be the case that history was written by the victors and we simply forgot what happened to the victims. But in the process of recompensing, we've stopped thinking about what it means to be an agent and the degree to which people actually do, I think, need heroes for inspirations, because heroes are people who show that certain ideals have actually been, they're people who actually lived those lives, okay? They're not abstract things. So yes, that's a book I've been working on for a long time. And we'll finish not before the end of 25. I've just got too much else to do before then. But it's a longer book, and so I want it to I want to get clear about more of it before I.
Are there any secret heroes? Any particular heroes or chapters? Is it organized like around individual potential hero figures from the past?
Or? Yeah, the past. I decided to restrict myself to dead people on the idea that there is one statement attributed to Aristotle, you can't call anyone happy before they're dead. I'm not sure that that's true, but I don't think you can call someone a hero until they're dead and people have actually taken a good look at all of their actions. So at the moment, I focus on four people. One is John Brown, the American abolitionist. One is, because I don't think heroes need to be military at all, one is George Eliot, the writer. Another is, I never thought this would be the case, but it's Albert Einstein, who I did not come to the Einstein Forum with an admiration for Einstein. In fact, I actually didn't like Einstein very much because I bought the public perception of him as this kind of brilliant but goofy guy with his head in the clouds and, you know, stumbling over his feet, which he wasn't at all. He was actually very brave, very radical, and very reasonable all through his life and very effective. And one is Paul Robeson, the great singer, actor, activist, who W.B. Du Bois once called the most famous American in the world, which was actually true when he said it in the middle of the century. If you took the whole world into consideration, but he's been quite forgotten. We're doing the last conference in our Enlightenment Festival is called The Universalism of Paul Robeson, and his granddaughter, who's a keeper of the family archive and so on, is coming along with a lot of other people from South Africa and India and elsewhere, talking about his impact.
Maybe linking this, what to ask.
I should also say I have a novel that's supposed to come out in the spring as well, so we'll see what happens.
Oh,
with that.
Cool.
So but that's already done.
Linking to what I've asked before regarding hope and about the heroes, I mean, this has to do also maybe creating a kind of vision for what could be left or what has to be. What can we learn maybe from these heroes? Especially when we come to the beginning of our talk, we talked about the universalism and what is human or humanism. We're facing a lot of transformation processes now, for example, this rise of artificial intelligence and a lot of threats. So if we look not only at your individual projects, but also but regarding the future, is there anything we can learn from those heroes regarding maybe projects of the left as well?
Oh, absolutely. Although whenever I hear a German use the word vision, I have to think of Helmut Schmidt's awful remark, anybody who has vision should go to the eye doctor.
Yes.
That's a problem in German culture, that they have come to distrust vision so deeply that they view it as suspicious. Look, there's not a vision, although all of the the heroes that I portrayed at some length are people who basically adhered to the principles that I lay out here. I think the main thing that we learn from those kinds of heroes is that it's actually possible to live by a set of ideals and to make some progress. Even though one can say, and that's why I took people who were, what exactly was Robeson's position on Stalin? And I mean, it's been much discussed. I don't think there's any absolute way to decide anymore, one way or the other. There's some historians who say he did join the Communist Party. This is vociferously denied by his son, who wrote two books about his father and said, he wasn't a party joiner, and it's just not something he would have done. He did accept the Stalin Prize, as did Picasso. You know, so I'm not arguing that heroes have no flaws, but I do try and understand the flaws, and because if we're heroes can't be models if they're entirely unflawed, right? Then they're saints or superheroes, comic book caricatures. But the idea being there are people who have genuinely taken risks, faced risks, and accepted them in pursuit of certain ideals. And they're people we can keep in mind at moments when our own hope threatens to falter. I mean, I certainly do. When I have moments in which I do not get up in the morning thinking, oh, goody, another day that's, in which I can make the world better. I have plenty of moments of despair myself. And those are times when I put on the music of Paul Robeson or think about
Einstein.
Yeah.
I had a poster of Einstein on my wall, actually, as a teenager.
Did you?
I'd completely forgotten about it. Until
now, which picture?
Not the one with the tongue out.
Thank heavens.
No, okay. No, but one, a more serious, I mean, his hair wasn't looking particularly well-kempt, but other than that, he looked reasonably serious.
I've been told I'm a good candidate for the Einstein Forum because of my hair.
I was thinking whether, and we're talking about Fromm and the question, I guess, of psychological attachment. Do you think that the need for heroes is something like, when we think about humanism as the pantheon of great world authors or great world global intellectuals or thinkers, people that one might admire or look up to for their intellectual, moral courage and so on. Do you think that humanist pantheon is a kind of post-tribal tribe, or that you're creating a family of attachment figures for yourself, which is not defined by your immediate social circumstances, family circumstances, class circumstances, ethnic, national, geographical circumstances, religious circumstances, but that you're actually able to find friends in history and friends in completely foreign cultures and environments that you do, and you develop a kind of, I mean, it's not trivial what you just said about, I struggle to get out of the morning until I hear Paul Robeson or I think of one of my heroes.
Not every day, but
on the really bad days.
That's how bad the news is.
Yeah. But that dynamic of attachment as and the need for, I think, someone like Andrei Tarkovsky, who is one of my favorite film directors, he says, you know, the human being needs another human being.
That's a nice statement. Look, what you're talking about would be a project way too big for any one person to do on their own. What I hope to do in this book, and I say this quite clearly, I hope some people will adopt some of my heroes, but what I'm trying to do is to provide examples, and not simply of examples of people, but also examples of a process. That is, how you can take a fairly controversial person and work through. All the people that I took are quite famous, and I don't ever mean to suggest that one needs to become a world historical figure in order to become a hero. We know lots of the whole concept of unsung hero is a real thing.
George Eliot's concept, isn't it, I think?
Absolutely. But simply because some people's lives have been so well researched, one can read a lot, sift through their works, sift through biographies and criticisms and say, okay, there was this flaw, there was this problem. I'm not so sure about, I like what Brown did at Harper's Ferry, not so sure about what he did at Osawatomie, you know, but, or Robeson's accepting the Stalin Medal or whatever. And nevertheless, I think I understand the thinking process that went into those decisions, even if I can't exactly justify it. And looking at this life as a whole on balance, this is someone I call a hero. And I'd like the book to be an invitation to exactly the sort of project you're talking about, that there should be some international body of people who, not, you know, I'm not talking about, I don't know, people going around in Che t-shirts or something. I'm talking about people really thinking about what it means to be a hero, who they want to honor, and who they would like to use as a, you know, a kind of a light for them to live by.
Yeah. I mean, from a psychoanalytical point of view, it's very important. Also, if we look at father and mother and other kind of orientation figures in our life, I think it's important. Of course, the position of the hero can be different, and I think then this brings us back again to a kind of social character structures of societies. In a very authoritarian society, and a more authoritarian hero is different than a kind of hero in a more, let's say, society where a kind of productive orientation, if we talk from is possible as well. And then we can maybe take a figure of a hero, also someone who brings us closer to how in this society we can develop a kind of productive orientation somewhere, I would understand it in this sense.
I mean, unfortunately, if you think about, you've stuck to dead people, if you're thinking about living people and who seems to qualify as a hero, the examples that I think of are all right wing, I would say. Well, they tend, I mean, somebody like Elon Musk, Steve Jobs, or he's passed away, but you've got that idealization of, you're shaking your head in disbelief.
I didn't realize there was, but I guess I don't read the right, I don't read much social media anyway, but I don't read the right ones. People are actually valorizing Elon Musk. He seems to be one of the more despicable people on the planet.
Well, but from the point of view as a model of somebody who has a vision, a leader's vision, and who's desperately energetic in trying to implement it.
Gosh,
and is persuaded.
So was Adolf Hitler. Sorry. I mean, I'm not equating the two.
But I mean, the question is, I mean, I feel the same way. Actually, we're going to be talking in another episode of this podcast about the Jordan Peterson phenomenon in psychology. And there is someone that I actually agree with a lot of what he says. I just wish he was significantly more left-wing than he is. And so the question, but I guess the question would be, in a society, as you say, where there is a, where the You must be productive. Is there a way that the left, are there left-wing heroes that cannot just be dismissed by people who are, let's say, realists about business or right of centre or economically conservative or committed to the kind of economic status quo? Can you think of figures who are legitimately of the left? Einstein is a relatively good example, because no one could accuse Einstein of having been lazy or a loafer. Maybe he was a bit of a Luftmensch, or he appears to have been a Luftmensch, but in fact was not. Nevertheless, there's an idea that Einstein embodies certain values that would be shared, perhaps towards the right end of the spectrum, at least in terms of self-discipline and hard work and everything that the right fears about the left, of the world turning into a place where nobody bothers to do any work and nothing gets built and we all end up living in squalor.
Well, I'm sorry, that's an awful lot of capitalist propaganda. I know. All the people that I mentioned are all absolutely hard work. Robeson said of himself he could sing in 26 languages and argue in 9. I mean, come on. If you read about how hard this man worked to learn the various crafts that he learned. But okay, look, I suppose that one of the things that motivated me with the Heroes Victims Project was actually the sense that the idea of the hero has been hijacked by the right, and that people, particularly in Germany, tend to identify heroes with military heroes. And, you know, there was such a revulsion and rejection of that the whole idea of the hero was rejected. I've had conversations in this country in particular, where people have said to me, can't you just say role model? And I said, no. The word role model was invented in the late 50s by a sociologist, whose name I now forget, but somewhere in the book, precisely because people had become afraid of the word hero, because they were afraid that it just meant military or indeed right-wing qualities. I suppose Ayn Rand is a would be the sort of person whose hero worship and set of values that her heroes adhere to is particularly strong. Yes, people do. I read those books as a teenager and found them. I think every teenager who ever thought of themselves as working a bit harder and being envied by people, but also slightly ostracized. Every teenager thrills to those books at a certain point in their lives. Some people don't grow out of it and realize that as admirable as some qualities of those figures are, they have others which are terrifying. But yeah, the funny thing is, you said Einstein will do because everybody loves Einstein. I fear that the reason why everybody loves Einstein is that they don't know all that much about him. And his politics were quite have been almost written out of history. It's not the photograph that gets passed around the most is the one with the tongue hanging out. So it's by virtue of actually setting up a particular figure of Einstein, which is not true to the human being Einstein, that everybody loves him. But I suspect if the people you're talking would look more closely at some other figures of whatever political persuasion, either they'd be afraid of them. I mean, the idea that we'd all be living in mud huts if we didn't have economic inequality is such a, it just seems to me so foreign to human psychology, including the psychology of, as I say, Elon Musk, loathsome as I think he is in many ways, he certainly never stops working. It's not that he's
lazy.
That's right. And he does not need any money. He could father 20 more children and support them all and take care of, whatever kinds of pleasure he enjoys right now.
Yeah. I mean, I have heard it said of him that he whether it's true or if it's apocryphal, I don't know, but he's so driven by the idea of humankind getting to Mars that he calibrates all of his human interactions and decides on their worthfulness based on the extent to which it's going to fast-forward human beings getting to Mars. And so everything he does can be understood in that framework. Now, that's not to say that that's a particularly psychologically healthy framework in which to live your life, but it's noteworthy, and there are plenty of people around the world at least find it interesting and are interested to find out what he's trying to do and why.
All I'm saying is he's a good example of the fact that people are motivated by other things than unequal incomes.
Well, I do think, I'll let you step in, Thomas, with the question. I do think the idea that if we don't have economic competition, and we don't have, let's say, decentralized economic planning, which I guess is the great lesson of the 20th century and the Cold War, that you need decentralized planning in order to allocate goods in a market system. But in any kind of, there's no plausible alternative to decentralized markets as an efficient mechanism of allocation. We haven't seen it yet. I do think that the idea that we could end up back in mud huts is more widespread on the right than you suggest. I think a lot of people do think that is their default human psychology, in fact, particularly in the United States, I would say.
I believe you. I just find it a very implausible view of human psychology, which we can... I mean, I find it really propaganda rather than a considered view of human psychology, even if people do a little self-reflection. Not too many people at least remarked on what I thought was kind of a nice joke, but it's not a good joke. It's not a joke, it's true. The psychological model that we're taught today is science, that is of evolutionary psychology, and the idea that people are only motivated by the desire to reproduce as much as possible and get power and wealth to reproduce as much as possible. It's true of Donald Trump, okay? It's not, Donald Trump is an outlier. That's actually, I believe, why those of us who loathe him are quite fascinated by him, because he so doesn't function the way other people do. We were spared a military coup on January 6th because the military hated him. The military, he was so scornful of the concept of honor. I mean, you've got people, this is not a defense of American foreign policy, but the people who go into the military, most of them do so because it's the only way they can get healthcare and education. So that's why the U.S. has an all-volunteer army. But they are trained with an ethos that prepares them to die for their country, okay? That is, they prepare them to have a higher ethical value than preserving their own lives. And Trump commented many times in the presence of his own generals, including one who had lost a son in Iraq, that this was a crazy way. He didn't understand why anybody would be so crazy as to behave this way, okay? So, you know, but most of us on reflection realize that we are not only moved by the desire for wealth and power, we do things for other reasons. And so I think the, you know, continuing to say, oh, well, without economic competition, we'd all be living in mud huts, is really not a considered psychological view at all. It's a piece of political propaganda.
Yeah, I mean, one could link it very well to Eric Fromm again, would I say? But somehow, I mean, it's funny, you talk about heroes, and I see you, and behind you there's this poster of Eric Fromm. And I mean, we having this Eric Fromm study center at our university somehow have Eric Fromm as a kind of hero figure, you could say.
Good.
We wouldn't name it, but it is somehow in a way. And what do? We do not glorify, we do not want to glorify a person who is dead for a long time, but somehow for us he's an example and somehow a guideline how to bring certain strands together and think critically about society and about transformation processes, but use it for our contemporary questions and finding it. So it's not a personification of anything.
Sure.
And one thing he's very critical of is kind of the marketing orientation, the marketing character, which becomes really dominant way of understanding oneself. And he calls it a kind of alienation, of course, that we have an alienated view on ourselves when we only think about marketing categories and being better than the others and just winning against the other and have a very individualized way and do not see how social we are at persons and how our whole existence is kind of depending on social relations, and we do not use others necessarily for our own purpose and our own benefit, but we need this kind of social relations as a kind of human existence. And I think this is pretty much in line what you say is a kind of very strange and ideological way of talking about economic competition as a basic.
Yes. You may or may not know, but I can highly recommend a 4-part documentary by the British filmmaker Adam Curtis called The Century of the Self. And because you're talking about psychoanalysts, he documents how Edward Bernays, Freud's nephew, invented basically the science of public relations and marketing and the ways in which that, you know, rather cleverly and I think nefariously changed many of our assumptions about what's natural. It wasn't before.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can take the emergence of the marketing mentality as a product of the Industrial Revolution and by extension an indirect product even of the Enlightenment, if you want to put it in those terms, that the way I understood Fromm is that the possible, in the old times, the pre-Enlightenment era of people living in their own villages in their mud huts, shall we say, that everyone knew that you were the shoemaker in the village. You couldn't expand your client base by traveling 30 miles somewhere else. There was everyone knew where you lived and they knew what your business was, and it wasn't really a great need for marketing. In the 19th century and then in the 20th century, massively accelerated, that it becomes less and less about what you actually do and your connection with your own trade, if you think of artisans or people who are working because for the love of what they do, all of what you described about people not wanting to retire because they have a sense of purpose and so on. The economic rewards of just being able to market yourself become so astronomically larger than just plying an honest trade. That's one of the main drivers of the pathologies that Fromm diagnosed in the 20th century and that we're still dealing with in probably an accelerated form in the 21st century. And I think that when I look at people a generation younger than me who've grown up automatically, I mean, I am just old enough to have a sense of shame about self-promotion.
Yes.
But it's not a joke. Like, if you're born after about 1990, you don't. It's not an economic option. If you're not, whether it's through cultivating your LinkedIn page, or exactly, it's turning yourself into a brand, and just the, and so you end up with a model of society which is it's an coming back to the left and right distinction, it's a right-wing society where everyone is their own business.
Right.
And that you can't rely on anything. We're constantly, you're not going to be having anything for your retirement. And so the way to secure your economic future, the way to secure the economic rights that the left would grant people as a matter of human rights and dignity, the way to do that is to turn yourself into a brand and then assure that you, and the, in the attention economy, that people are looking at you. And that, yeah, there's that, that creates unbelievable social pathologies for individuals, but also it poisons social relations at the core, it seems to me.
I agree with you entirely. And I wouldn't trace it all the way back from the Enlightenment. I think that's a tenuous genealogy. I mean, I sometimes have the feeling these days that people, you know, 100 years ago, when people talked about what they were worried about, and this was true of writers and thinkers of any political stripe, well, it was the modern, die moderne, you know? And I think 100 years later, we tend to talk about the Enlightenment as if it that were a more precise way of talking about where all our problems began. And I don't think it is. I think we need to think seriously, first of all, about the phenomenon of capitalism, which was not, I mean, this is one of the things that the Enlightenment did not think about. They couldn't have, okay? They couldn't have thought about the dangers of capitalism. They were just getting out of feudalism. So you have the development of capitalism in the 19th century, and then you have the development of marketing in the 20th, which is another, I think, needs to be considered separately. But yeah, both are problems. And I worry, as you do, and I honestly don't have a good idea about what, how to get people out of turning themselves into products as well as businesses. I mean, it's like everybody is supposed to be both their own business and their own product. I don't have a good idea right now.
Well, it's a shame. This was the whole idea of bringing you along, was to solve these difficult problems.
Yeah.
I mean, you say you don't have an idea, but you're director of the Einstein Forum, and I won't say you will all solve all the problems, but I think one of important things, I don't know if you agree, is like bringing people into dialogue and like having, creating a kind of public sphere to think differently. And you mentioned a bit before the power of ideas as well, which may spread, and maybe you could reflect a bit upon this. And maybe I saw you came from Yale University before. And I mean, if we look what is...
Well, it's not quite... Yeah, but all right.
You have some connections, let's say that.
I taught there for 6 years.
Yes. And if we look at the U.S. now, for example,
what
happened at the universities at Columbia, for example, at Harvard, the kind of really violent protests going on, and what discussions, what can be expressed, what cannot be expressed, like what I can see is like that public spaces, or at least open spaces of discussion, get threatened by these partly violent discussions. So don't you think that we all have, like you as director of Einstein Forum, we some are working at universities, also the possibility to influence? And
well, if I didn't think that there were possibilities of influence through the free, respectful, and critical discussion of ideas, I wouldn't be here. That's why I went into philosophy, first teaching at a couple of universities and then running the Einstein Forum in the hope that that would give me a larger public forum to do this kind of work. So, of course, I think it's possible. Of course, I think it's important. We're, of course, not as big as Harvard or Columbia. We've had a couple of demonstrations on two occasions, but not recently. I think it's frightening to see how many university administrators, both in Germany as well as in the U.S., have let themselves be bullied by the right. This is not to defend everything that was said, good Lord, in every one of those demonstrations or occupations, but it is to say, and this is what I truly don't understand, sick the police on a bunch of 20-year-olds? Do you think that's going to do anything but make them feel more angry, more radicalized, less able to listen to reason? I mean, it just shows an absolute lack of understanding of, again, you know, student psychology. One friend of mine who's a professor at Columbia and who visited and tried to mediate in the encampments said, well, it showed that the new professor, the new president of Columbia had no, she had no real teaching experience. She had come from, I forget where she'd come from, but anyway, not from a university background, from something in finance. And he said she had no understanding of how students work. But interestingly enough, basically the same thing has repeated itself in every or almost every university. So it's not simply that one university administration didn't have the understanding of how students work, but honestly, do you have to have experience teaching students to know that if you violently arrest someone, which itself is usually an act of violence, right, you're going to somehow bring them to reason? I mean, just, it's very troubling.
I mean, you made a conscious decision to exit the university system, and you said you wanted to address a broader public. Thomas Nagel defines the challenge of the kind of work that we're doing, whether it's about the belief in progress or belief in some sort of social, political, moral, intellectual progress, is that the difference between that and just purely scientific progress is that scientific progress can happen in the minds of a few experts that are free to talk to each other in languages that the rest of the general public doesn't understand. I can still benefit from two biologists getting together and exchanging ideas on, vaccine technology that I can benefit from. It's hard to make the same case in the humanities. Obviously, the social sciences are a grey area, but there's a sense in which humanistic dialogue and that the humanities in general require everyone has to be pulled along somehow in order for all of the boats of society to rise together. And that's a fundamentally different enterprise to the scientific enterprise, which is about publication in specialized journals, ever smaller numbers of experts talking to each other about problems that the rest of the world can't even understand, let alone solve. Are you optimistic that there can be a global language of humanism commensurate with the rate of current globalization?
I am never optimistic.
Hopeful, I apologize.
Okay. All right. You know, I am. And this is anecdotal, but I think it's important. One of the members of my board of trustees who I inherited, I didn't appoint myself, was the former president of Hebrew University. He is a physicist and an Einstein specialist. Okay? And for years, we liked each other immediately. For years, he would say in the board meetings, you need to do more natural science. And I would say, well, you knew when you hired me that I wasn't a natural scientist. And, I have tried through people who are historians of science or people who are, it is really impossible or almost impossible to get natural scientists to talk about their work in a way that is intelligible to somebody who's not a specialist. We've tried, stop giving me a hard time about it. So this time we had a meeting in which he actually said the opposite. He said, we need more humanities. And I said, what? he said, yeah, we need more humanities because the scientists are not interested in learning the things that need to be known at this moment. They're very condescending. I mean, I had said this to him 10 years ago, but okay. They're condescending towards the humanities. People from the humanities want to learn from the sciences, but it's simply not the other way around. Now, I mean, why I take this as a little bit of anecdotal evidence for hope is that even somebody who is, you know, as committed a physicist as one can be, can, if he's old and wise enough, can see what's happening in the world in the absence of, you know, a broader respect for the humanities. There is, of course, a problem with funding, because it's STEM that gets better funded than anything. And it's much harder to describe output. People did, after 9/11, there was a moment of hope that actually maybe it was the humanities that were needed, that there were values and clashes that needed to be explored. Let's see if people will be wise enough to realize that we do need this kind of discussion of value and meaning and hope.
That everybody can understand.
That everybody can understand. I mean, this is why I always have trouble with the German word Wissenschaft, because I don't...
Me too.
But there's not too much that I can do about that as long as I live here.